welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, poddies and laddies, welcome to another LNL. I promised last night that this entire program was going to be in Esperanto. Why? Well, the year 2007 is the international language's 120th year of existence. In fact, we're almost to the 150th anniversary of the birth of its creator, Lazarus Ludwig Zamenhof. And then I discovered a small problem. While Bruce Shapiro is, of course, fluent in Esperanto, as he is in Yiddish, I'm not. So I've decided I'm going to have a crash course in Esperanto so we can do the whole program in Esperanto next week. And this is fair warning, because you, of course, as listeners, will have to learn it as well, because although Paul's great at the knobs out there, we can't do subtitling on a radio program. Then, after I talked to Shapiro, in Yiddish, I think, tonight, we're then going to have a chat with a couple of academics who have come up with a long list of American wars in which, I have to say, they didn't work out the way they were intended. In fact, it seems that almost every war that the Americans have conducted, and they have conducted so many of them, have had, to say the least, unintended consequences. In fact, that's the name of the book and the name of the chat, Unintended Consequences. And it was an unintended consequence when we hired Shapiro a while back, because no one would have dreamed that he would have become so popular and so adored by the gladdies and the potties. Personally, I can't stand him. How are you, Bruce?
Ah, Philip, was macht ihr? I'm good, and we're having a sort of a Yiddish Mardi Gras here.
Well, it is Mardi Gras time, isn't it, somewhere?
It is indeed. It's Mardi Gras in New Orleans, Mardi Gras in the rural areas of Louisiana, where you have a very different... the great traditional Cajun Mardi Gras, people going from house to house in the countryside begging for food with masks and dances and gathering rice and sausage for communal gumbos. It's an extraordinary time.
A communal gumbo, that sounds fantastic. You're not on a float this year.
I'm not on a float. Right now I'm in the Brass Monkey region of the United States, the Brass Monkey Belt, where it's quite cold, although in a couple of days I actually will be going down to New Orleans, where I haven't been in some months. This has been a tough time down there. You know, people have been, of course, paying ongoing attention to the aftermath of Katrina. What's been happening lately, though, is an upsurge in violence there, of street shootings of teenagers and young people, which parallels something happening all over the United States right now, but is worse in New Orleans than anywhere else, and it's having a really demoralizing effect on a lot of the folks who live there. It's a very uncertain time.
Okay, you're not on a float, and I must say, let's do a segue here, that Hillary Clinton is barely afloat. She's having a few problems, isn't she?
Well, she's struggling, as of course all the politicians are, with the Iraq issue, but in her case she's struggling in a particular way. The Democratic electorate, and indeed most of the Democratic Congress, of course, is really quite squarely against the war and looking for ways out. Hillary is trying to accommodate that in her, you know, official run for president, and yet she has this historical problem, which is, of course, that she voted for the war. Now, some of the candidates, former Senator John Edwards, Senator Christopher Dodd, have officially backed off of their, or in fact renounced their pro-war votes back from 2003. Senator Clinton has refused to do so. As recently as the last couple of weeks in New Hampshire, in Iowa, when given opportunities, when asked by voters how she reconciles her stance now, where she says essentially it's a lost cause, it's time for a new strategy, with that past vote, she will not declare that she was wrong. And this, in a curious way, I think, actually ties us to New Orleans, because I think there's something of a hunger in the electorate right now for politicians who can admit they were wrong. We've had you know, a succession.
Oh, now, and Bruce, I've got to interrupt. A politician admitting that he or she was wrong.
Well,
that is as rare as rocking horse manure.
Well, if that's the case, then right now the presidential, the Democratic contest is piled high in rocking horse manure because you've got all of these senators bending over, falling over one another to prove they're wrong. I mean, the truth is actually that Clinton and all of the senators, other than Obama, who was not in the Senate at the time, but all of those currently running for president who were in the Senate, Biden, Dodd, all of them voted for the war, and they're all having to come to terms with that in ways that are not satisfactory. And in Hillary's case, she has an additional problem, which is that she believes it would be a mistake for a woman in particular to show herself as less than tough, that she would rather tough out criticism then seem to change her position in response to public sentiment about the war. There's a bit of a sort of
feminism does raise some difficult issues, doesn't it?
Well, it does. One thinks of Margaret Thatcher and her sort of need to prove that she was harder, sharper edged than any male Tory who had come along in Britain. And I think there's something of that in Hillary at the moment. It's not clear, though, how this is going to play. I mean, if you looked at Congress over the last week, where the House of Representatives voted really pretty overwhelmingly with, you know, more than a dozen Republicans joining with the Democrats to condemn the troop surge, and a majority of U.S. senators, majority of Democrats, all but Joe Lieberman and four Republicans, also supported a similar resolution, though not enough to bring it to the floor, according to Senate rules. You've got a majority of both houses now on record against the troop surge, and in a way that's really not precedented. Not even until the last stages of the Vietnam War did you find the U.S. Congress intervening so directly to turn down the heat on a president's determination to keep the heat high.
If you look at American politics, presidential politics, through the prism of celebrity, it's fascinating. The great advantage is that Hillary is the best-known brand name, well, after the Bushes, I guess, in U.S. politics, and other celebrity brand names, the Hollywood push, who were so important to a Democrat candidate in fundraising, are now leaving Hillary in considerable numbers, you know, Spielberg, etc., and they're going for Obama. And one of the reasons they seem to be leaving her is because she has equivocated.
I think it's equivocation, but I think it's more than that. I think there's also a great fear that Hillary herself and the name Clinton remain so polarizing in certain parts of the country and to certain parts of the right that it will become very easy to mobilize people's resentment.
I have never seen more vile websites or, you know, hate pages than Hillary, in fact, provokes.
Well, I mean, that is true. I mean, she and Bill Clinton, of course, became seen by the far right, and by the kind of far right that plays out in the mass media, like Fox and on Rush Limbaugh, as emblematic of 60s countercultural relativism. And this, of course, wasn't really the Clintons at all. The truth is that President Clinton and Hillary, along with them, were really quite conservative in their promotion of welfare reform and their, you know, refusal to back needle exchange, so on and so forth. This was not... These were not really progressive inhabitants of the White House, yet they have become identified in a large part of the media mind, if not quite all the public mind. They become identified with cultural relativism. Now, interestingly enough, today's New York Times reports that certain key past opponents of the Clintons on the right, some of the people who really threw big rocks at them on these cultural grounds, have now decided that, well, maybe President Clinton wasn't so bad after all, especially the part of the right that is alarmed by Iraq. And we have to remember that the right is not one thing in the United States. There are multiple rights, multiple conservative movements. I think, nonetheless, that a lot of Democrats, the Spielbergs who you mentioned, are in part genuinely worried that Hillary remains too polarizing a figure, too dangerous a figure to run as a candidate at a time when there's a real chance of taking back the White House.
Let's look at another dangerous figure. You will, of course, be Late Night Live's correspondent at the forthcoming Hicks trial in Guantanamo, won't you?
Glad to do it. You can get me the press
pass.
How many
of those trials have you attended so far? How many have there actually been?
Well, there haven't been any.
Oh.
There's been no trial at all, and that's part of the great scandal is that not a single military tribunal has, been.
Forgive me, Bruce. I just thought you'd been lazy and slack. I didn't realize this.
There has not been a one, and in part that's because the rules that the Bush administration kept throwing up for these things, throwing out, were so egregious that various courts threw them out. Now, Congress and the courts seem to have agreed on a process. It is possible that Hicks and a few other detainees will face trials, although I would not bet my money on it happening.
Well, you'll have to hurry because our Prime Minister and our Foreign Minister, who wanted Hicks to stay there for 1,000 years, before a non-parole period, are now organising a Mardi Gras for him to bring him back. There's going to be cheering crowds.
Well, that parade,
even if he's convicted.
Well, my guess is that there will in fact be some sort of negotiated settlement to the Hicks case. It's hard for me to imagine a military tribunal of an English-speaking white Australian really playing well, but it's hard to predict what the Bush administration is going
I've,
to
I've
do
found
in
that
final
over
days.
The years. That's true. They are hard to predict. Now, I want you to help out. As you know, next week your slot in the program, our man in Washington, will be Dick Cheney, who's coming out to do this job, and I think he's also seeing the Prime Minister. While he's here, what do you think he's going to ask of us? Do you think another like your new Democrat front runner? Is he going to ask us to send more people to Iraq?
Are
we expected to surge?
I think he is going to ask where a safe place he can go and hide for a few months is to stay out of the public eye while Bush gets through the next couple of months. Cheney has, in effect, turned into the lightning rod for the whole administration. His job, in fact, is to go be provocative. I suspect that while in Australia he will say many provocative things. We've really seen this in the Scooter Libby trial. One of the things, the most important thing in some ways that's come out of this trial of Cheney's former aide is the picture of just how powerful this vice president is, or at least was, just how much political control he was given, just how much freedom he was given to push the president's policies and to be the front man in a way that no vice president in memory has been, certainly not even as potent an ego as Lyndon Johnson.
Look, we've got to, in parenthesis, just remind the listener that Libby's, well, you tell him, why is Libby on trial?
Irwin Scooter Libby on trial in Washington for leaking, allegedly lying to the grand jury, a grand jury, about who leaked the name, the identity of Valerie Plame, CIA agent wife of Joseph Wilson, the critic of the Iraq war and denouncer, debunker of the Niger yellow cake uranium claim.
And of course the defense team for Libby make it clear that her name was in every second fortune cookie and on huge posters on Broadway, weren't they? Everyone knew.
That's been going on. More the real defense has been that Scooter Libby has said, maybe I said something different than what I told the grand jury, but I can't remember. It's basically a I can't remember defense,
right,
in which he said this was not important enough and I can't tell you what I said on what day. We'll see what's happened. I suspect that Libby himself may be cooked, but historically not much is coming out of this trial except this rich mine of data about the role of Dick Cheney in the administration, which really...
Of course, earlier in the administration, it was a subject of great attention and indeed of parody. You know, the argument was that he was totally dominant and that George was really just a ventriloquial doll sitting on his knee.
Well, and I don't think that was ever accurate. I think that Bush is very much his own man, but he and Cheney did share these crucial goals around the conduct of the war on terror. They absolutely, it's clear now, see eye to eye on Iraq, see eye to eye on the neoconservative vision of remaking the Middle East, and see eye to eye as well on Guantanamo and the power of the president to do an end run around Congress on these things. That has been Cheney's job. He's been the cheerleader for presidential power, something that he's really done since he was an aide to Gerald Ford in 1974.
And well, I look forward to him sitting in just for a couple of weeks in your posse, and but I know you will join us in due course when you've learned Esperanto. Bruce, thank you very much for that. Bruce Shapiro, our regular voice from within the Beltway on Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, Semaphore, Pigeon, etc., and downloadable onto your pod. A bit of music, please, Paul. Unintended consequences. Are there any other kind? But we're going to look at unintended consequences as they apply to war, of which I would have thought the current effort in Iraq has to be on the short list with its unintended consequences. The shock and awe in and out with very little collateral war that was envisaged by the administration and the coalition of the willing back in 2003, has turned into what some describe as a quagmire, a catastrophe, even another Vietnam. But my next two guests would argue that every one of the last 10 major wars the US has been involved in have had unintended consequences. In fact, it was that 19th century Prussian soldier and military theorist Clausewitz who acknowledged that the fog of war, isn't that wonderful? The fog of war made unpredictability of the course and outcome inevitable. Historians Ian Bickerton and Kenneth Hagen have made an historical review of those last 10 wars, and it demonstrates that in each case they resulted in outcomes far, far removed from those intended at their outset. Ian Bickerton, and we were reminding each other that we met on a flight to Los Angeles about 10 million years ago, is currently visiting research fellow in the School of History at the University of New South Wales, and he's sitting opposite me in the Sydney studio. And from his bunker at the US Naval War College in California, Kenneth Hagen, who's a professor of strategy and policy. Their book to be published this month is called Unintended Consequences, The United States at War, and I welcome both of you to our little wireless program.
Well, thank you, Philip.
And I must... And Kenneth and I congratulate you. Looking down the contents page at all the wars you're dealing with, I note with pleasure that you've been even-handed. About half of them are Republican wars, the other half are Democrat wars, and they all seem to have ended up in pretty much the same mess. Ken, where did the idea for your book come from?
Well, the idea came from a review I was doing for the students who are mid-career Marines and naval officers down at Monterey, and I was summarizing the course and what it might mean, and this was about 3 years ago, and I realized that we were getting into quite a mess in Iraq, and I just made a list of similar situations that had occurred after major wars of the United States and presented that to the students. I was quite surprised at the list and how easy it was to compile. And I sent it down to Ian, and from that point on, the book evolved. And Ian thought it was a good idea, so did I, and then we set up the format that we've used, which is to introduce each war from the president's perspective, fight the war, so to speak, and then look at the unintended consequences.
Kenneth, it's fascinating to me that having removed the scales from the eyes of many of the students over the years, before the coins are placed on their eyes, they go back to these wars. You teach them, you know, the almost inevitable mess that lies ahead. But they're so patriotic that they still go back.
Absolutely, they do. And, of course, you're dealing with different generations. I was teaching the fathers of this generation at the Army Command and General Staff School between 1969 and 73 in the Nixon years. They were going back to the second and third tours. And what has struck me is how remarkably similar those Army majors were to today's students in terms of their patriotism, their enthusiasm. They also have high moral character, and they're bright, they're alert and quick. And
no cynicism.
The cynicism comes after a while. It's come now more so in the last couple of years than it was there, than was there 5 years ago. When I first raised the issue of Vietnam's similarity to the Iraq War, one of the students said, it's time for me, Ken Hagen, to get over Vietnam. And that's not the case now. They're interested in the parallels between Vietnam and the present. The cynicism comes on as the time goes by, but then they revert back to their more ebullient and optimistic point of view.
A couple of months ago, I talked to an American Muslim who'd been on the staff at Guantanamo. And he suddenly becomes the focus of investigation. He's accused of everything up to and including the bombing of, the bombing of Afghanistan. I'm sorry, everything up to and including the attacks on the towers. He's put through hell, and at the end of it, he's still a patriotic Marine on the program. It's an extraordinary phenomenon that people can hold to these core values.
Yes, well, it is extraordinary, and what I try to do is to temper that with reason and then hope that in the next generation, when these now young men and women are in positions to make the same kinds of decisions for war or peace, that they will be more restrained and more cautious about going to war. However, I must admit that my experience with those in Vietnam and watching it, the process in the intervening 30 years or so, I really have no reason to be optimistic. And so then I fall back to the position of satisfying myself with awakening a few, having a good discussion with some of them, and thinking that in one or two cases I've actually caused them to rethink their values and their intellectual processes. So it becomes a rather humble and modest undertaking instead of a sweeping one, such as I may have had 25 or 40 years ago when I first met Ian and we were young and optimistic.
Now, Ian, we'll get on to the American-Spanish War, Vietnam and the current war in a moment or two, but let's look at the fourth of your major wars in the contents here. The Civil War of 1861, which wasn't, of course, initially fought to free slaves. Why did Lincoln go to war?
Well, he went to war essentially to restore the Union. He saw virtually half the nation, if you like, separating, disappearing, and he was determined that that was not going to happen. He wanted, not only did he want to maintain the Union as such, he probably wanted to expand control the Union had over all of North America, and had he probably, had things gone differently, might well have expanded or sought to expand into Canada. I mean, this is a nation that is determined to maintain and expand its territory at all costs.
It's interesting, and I won't labour the parallels occur all the way through your book, but it's interesting that he intended few of the things that transpired over the next 4 years. He said publicly that he expected a short and limited war, and he quickly learnt that the three-month term of enlistment for the militia wasn't quite sufficient.
No, well, it's a bit... I mean, one is drawn immediately to the notion that Bush thinks 21,000 more soldiers in Iraq, this surge, is going to make a difference when In fact, only a year ago, there were 75,000 troops unable to pacify Baghdad, and it would need another 75 or 150,000 more Americans to pacify, if that's the correct word, Baghdad, or maintain peace and law and order in that city. And it's always the case that chief executives underestimate the length of time, the number of troops, the number of casualties, civilian and military, and the resultant damage and so on.
Well, as the book points out, we're talking a war that killed 600,000 people. If you're to quantify that in terms of current demographics, it would be equivalent to losing, 5 million. And it's a war that cost $20 billion.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, the point, I suppose, is that there are better ways of unifying the nation, or bringing the nation, or bringing the South within the control of the North, than going to war with them. And invariably, we've found that when you look at these turning points towards war or continued negotiation, the continued negotiation option would probably produce the desired outcome more effectively, cheaply, in better ways than the resort to arms.
But Ian, you also argue that there's a turning point in a war.
Yes, well, Ken's more familiar with those than I am, because he's more the military historian, but it's true that in these situations there's always a point at which the war escalates or goes in a different direction, and that's the outcome that we look at.
What was the turning point in the Civil War, do you think, Ken?
The turning point in the Civil War was the Battle of Antietam, which was in the fall of 1862, and Robert E. Lee lost that battle. As a result of losing the battle, the British made the decision not to intervene, not to recognize the Confederacy as a sovereign nation, and to give it aid. They were on the fence. Palmerston was very close to doing so. Lord Russell was going to advocate intervention on behalf of the South, and they saw the Battle of Antietam and they said, we shall remain lookers-on across the Atlantic a while longer. In addition to that phenomenon following from the Battle of Antietam, Lincoln saw the chance to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, and he did this during a congressional election year with that definitely in mind, to affect the outcome of the congressional elections, and also for propaganda purposes, by changing the war from one of reunification to one for the elimination of slavery, he hoped to gain moral support overseas, and also greater moral support at home. The result of it was, of course, of the hardening of the Southern resistance, intensification of the conflict, and ultimately General U.S. Grant coming in with his what has been called accurately his strategy of annihilation, which replaced the original strategy of encirclement advocated by an older general, Winfield Scott, which earlier strategy Lincoln had rejected because he thought it would take too long. So you have a four-year war, which was certainly a long war, with those enormous casualties you mentioned. And our point in the book is that the turning point came with the Battle of Antietam.
I want to get back to the consequences, the unintended consequences of that war in a minute, but it suddenly occurs to me, Ian Bickerton, that very often the pretext for going into war is a bit shonky, whether it's WMDs or Johnson's Tonkin.
Yes.
Incident.
Yes.
Is that a pattern you've seen looking at other wars, that there was often a furphy involved in getting the drums beating?
Yes, it's almost always the case that a situation is either created, deliberately created, such as the Bay of Tonkin incident, or in the case of the Mexican War, the stationing of troops on the Mexican border, waiting for an assault from an enemy, or even provoking an assault by an enemy. And then it's portrayed as a defensive action by the United States to retaliate against an unwarranted, unjustified, wicked attack by a country whose morals are to be questioned and who doesn't respect the rule of law and so on and so on. Now, that occurs even in the case of the Spanish-American War. You have the sending of the Maine down to Havana Harbor. Whether the exact circumstances of that explosion are unknown, but certainly it's a provocative act, and it's done with the knowledge that the likelihood is that a war will eventuate from it.
Okay, unintended consequences, civil war. The big unintended consequence, the abolition of slavery, terrific. That's a very good thing. What about unintended consequences that weren't so good, Ian?
Well, you have the main unintended consequence, I believe, is that the United States government then turned its attention to pacifying the West, or that is to say, waging war with experienced veterans from the Civil War, North and South, against Native Americans to enable settlement to occur of in the post-war years. And so you have a brutal assault on the Plains Indians, the Southwest Indians, which lasted up until 1893 and even beyond, another 30 years of concerted warfare against Native Americans. Now, the question, I suppose, is that unintended or intended, and would it have occurred anyway? There's no doubt the settlement would have occurred and the expansion would have occurred, but possibly with a somewhat different pattern of negotiations, perhaps even the Canadian model.
Mm. This is LNL on ABC Radio National Radio Australia via ABC Online, downloadable onto your pod for our poddies, and I'm talking to historians Ian Bickerton and Kenneth Hagen about their book Unintended Consequences, The United States at War. Over the years on the program, I've talked to quite a few Vietnam vets of one sort or another, from McNamara to Daniel Ellsberg on the Vietnam War, with them making, I think, quite compelling observations about the current engagement and seeing certain parallels. Ken, do you think that's stretching it, or do you see similarities other than Tonkin and weapons of mass destruction, other than that, between these conflicts?
Oh, I think there's enormous parallels, and distressingly so. The turning point, such as the Tet Offensive of 1968, was clearly a turning point in the Vietnam War. In the last 4 months, we reached that kind of a turning point, it seems to me, in which the war can be seen to have been virtually lost. And yet what you have after the Tet Offensive, you have yet another 5 years of war continuing under President Nixon, unable or unwilling to get out of the conflict, at the cost, and McNamara admits this himself, of another 25,000 dead Americans, countless Cambodians and North Vietnamese. And it seems to me that today we're on the border of that sort of a continuation, an inability to get out, unwillingness to reach any kind of a decisive conclusion, inability to do so.
There's also, isn't there a strange parallel between what's going on in the Democratic Congress over the appropriation bill for Iraq and what happened with limiting money in the Vietnam War?
Well, in the Vietnam War, they were able to limit money. They didn't really start to squeeze the administration until the middle of 1969, about 5-6 months after Nixon was in the presidency. But that's the key to evaluating what the current Congress is going to do. Will the House of Representatives actually begin to reduce, curtail appropriations for the war? They're on the verge of being faced with a $100 billion dollar appropriation, supplemental appropriation bill, and that would offer them the opportunity to make selective and selected reductions.
Well, Kenneth, you better get your nice new book safely into the hands of Nancy Pelosi. It's a matter of urgency.
Well, actually, I live in San Francisco part of the time, so I would hope she would be interested in getting a copy. So far it hasn't been available to send to her, but I'll give it a try.
Ian, what's interesting is that it's actually the Spanish-American War of 1898 where you see the most similarities with Iraq. Why?
Well, I see it, the similarities because the way in which it's presented to the American people, that it was a regime change because we had a ruthless regime that needed to be changed, that we would bring the United States, that is, we would bring democracy to the and free people, that we would be welcomed as liberators, that we had a technological superiority, that it would be a quick war, it would be a morally justifiable war, and that we would also, of course, have financial benefits to be gained from it in terms of the Caribbean stability and trade and plantations and so on. And it quickly developed into a war in which bases in the Pacific are gained. And then suddenly, instead of liberating Filipinos, we discover that we need to rule over them because they're incapable of doing it themselves. And an insurgency or a war against the United States. It's better called the Spanish-Cuban-Philippine-American War rather than the Spanish-American War. And an insurgency that lasts 2 or 3 years, terrible bloodshed on both sides, cruelty, torture.
There's another similarity which is really makes me feel very uneasy, and that is that McKinley, the president at the time, like Bush, portrayed himself as deeply religious and acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty.
It's a hallowed tradition among American presidents, especially when they go to war. If you don't have God on your side, you're very unlikely to win. And so that's true. And he was surrounded by expansionist advisors, militaristic advisors, a press that was anxious to popularize the war, a Congress that was willing to allocate funds for it. I mean,
so the neocons for McKinley were the likes of Theodore Roosevelt and Cabot Lodge
and Alfred Thayer Mahan, the naval captain. That's right.
Right. How extraordinary. McKinley
went one step further. He said that he had to take the Philippines because he got down on his knees and prayed, and God told him to.
Is that true?
It's what he said.
It's what he said.
He had other reasons, but he did say that. Yes.
So Henry Kissinger wasn't there to witness the scene on this particular occasion. Okay, Kenneth, the Americans ostensibly started the war against Spain to free Cuba from this oppressive Spanish rule. Why did they really do it, though?
Oh, I think they did it with that in mind, and I think they wanted a Caribbean empire, and they would have replaced Spain as the ruler of Cuba, but in order to get the votes for the war, they had to tolerate an amendment which prohibited them from actually taking possession of Cuba. So you ended up with an empire in which the jewel of the empire in the Caribbean was actually not part of the American empire. And that's one of the great ironies. Ian and I have discussed the extent to which they had an eye on the Philippines all along. I tend to think that they didn't, that what happened with the Philippines was that when Commodore Dewey defeated the Spanish fleet on May 1st of 1898, the Spanish did not surrender Manila, and therefore the U.S. Army was required lay siege to and then take possession of Manila. And in order to get the army over there and to support it, the Americans then took the islands on the way, which were Hawaii, Wake, and Guam. And so it was, it seems to me at least, that this was an unintended consequence, and I think Ian sees it as more intentional. But it's absolutely remarkable that the announced purpose of a war was to free the Spanish people from the Cuban people from Spanish oppression, and it leads to half a century almost of American occupation of the Philippines, and other indirect consequences, most notably the confrontation with Japan for primacy in the Far East, or at least in the Western Pacific.
And as you point out, just as in the early stages of the current Iraq War, the conventional military phase was over quickly. Victory was never in doubt.
within hours in the Philippines, and it was over by July 3rd in Cuba. It took longer in Cuba because they had to actually ship the army there.
What do you think, Ian, about Ken's unintended consequences? You have a slight ideological difference here.
Yes. It's the rhetoric that surrounds these events. It's a little bit hard to determine because rhetoric is not necessarily decision-making, but it reminds me very much of the rhetoric that surrounds the current war and the hostility towards Syria and Iran. I get terribly troubled when I hear all this rhetoric because I'm not quite sure whether the real motives are Iran and Syria or whether that's an unintended outcome.
And of course, we're looking at a much broader series of issues when we look at this intervention, because as a Pacific imperial power, the US joins briefly with other great powers in the decisive military invention in China to repress the Boxer Rebellion. And there's tensions with Japan.
Yes, well, Ken's much more interested in following that thread than I am. And Ken, perhaps you'd like to comment on what you think.
Yes, Ken, the wider implications and indeed repercussions.
Oh, I think the wider implications, the widest implication would be Pearl Harbor and December 7th of 1941, because when the Americans occupied the Philippines and then, as you pointed out, took place in the suppression of the Boxer Rebellion, they also announced the policy of the open door towards China and would not tolerate any partition of China. And in that way, and also with their naval presence, they were an obstruction to Japanese expansion. The Japanese had, the Americans felt at least, that the Japanese had an eye on the Philippines as early as 1898.
Mm.
So I think that you can trace that confrontational attitude between the Americans and the Japanese back to the success, if you will, or the acquisition of the Philippines.
And you know, Ken, the fascinating thing is I think the overwhelming majority of Americans and others know little, if nothing, of any of this. They're not even aware of the so-called banana wars, you know, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Nicaragua.
And our book won't enlighten them too much on that because we've concentrated on on these 10 major wars. Max Boot's book, Savage Wars of Peace, and a few others have traced those other wars, which are parallel, really, to what we say about the major wars.
Now, gentlemen, I tried to book this Prussian military theorist Clausewitz for the program, but we couldn't get him. So I wonder if you could speak to this fascinating fellow. Ian, he writes in his book On War, famously, that war is merely the continuation of policy by other means. How did he see war?
Well, he saw it very much in that Napoleonic tradition of armies, massed armies, meeting in battlefields and having a decisive outcome, a battle in which an outcome was decisive, and then negotiations would follow in which decisions were made, treaties signed, and so on. And whatever dispute was the cause of the war would have been resolved, in theory at least.
In this formal sense.
Yes.
Like a chess match.
Yes.
An Olympic event.
Yes. But
very tidy.
Well, it seemed tidy at the time, and of course, but if you look at Europe in the post-Napoleonic period, it didn't seem to work out the way the treaties or Napoleon or anybody else had thought of at the time.
Mm.
And subsequent developments of war, particularly probably with the American Civil War, into this war of annihilation in which civilians increasingly become targets and so on and so on. The whole question of whether or not a war is going to resolve these things in the way Clausewitz saw them becomes much more problematic.
Are there Clausewitzians today who see war as a rational and legitimate means of furthering national interests? And if so, are they called neocons?
Well, Ken has traced the emergence of this group in the American military, and I'm sure he can tell us about that.
Okay, Ken, tell us.
Well, I think especially since the Vietnam War, the Clausewitzians have emerged with great strength in the American strategy-making apparatus. It's a source of, it's an example of rather bitter irony that the frustration over Vietnam led many in the army to advocate large wars and attacking central points of the opponents. They were thinking that they should have attacked North Vietnam, of course. And this idea of using war as an instrument of that kind of policy and using big battles to affect policy has really taken hold. And I think accounts to a large extent for their current Iraq war. It seems to me that it's a strange situation that the Americans have a great sense of nostalgia for World War II, and that they fail to realize that in the case of both Korea, in the case of Korea, of Vietnam, and now Iraq, they've tried to use war as an instrument of policy, and in every one of these cases, it hasn't worked out. And so one of the major points of our book is to try to raise the question as to whether war can, in fact, in the modern age for sure, be a rational instrument of policy, and we conclude it can't.
Let me ask you this. What nourishment do the Clausewitzians find out of World War II, Ian?
Well, I think they find out two things stand out to me. The first is overwhelming technological superiority and firepower, based on sort of economic and manufacturing capacity. And so the United States saw itself as won the war because it was the arsenal for democracy and its manufacturing capacity. And the second is the use of air power, the belief that casualties can be held to an absolute minimum on the side of the United States, and that air power, which came out of World War I in part, but certainly it seemed to be the dominant factor, and the belief that air power would win wars, and the technological capacity to, and they've searched for smarter weapons, more destructive weapons, weapons that will travel further, faster, all those things.
Okay, let's go back to Clausewitz, because he's fascinating. The unintended consequences from fog and friction invalidates his basic proposition, Ian. You say he's not only wrong, he was seriously wrong. War does not continue policy, it radically alters it.
Well, that's true. I mean, if your policy is to regime change and pacify and create democracy in Iraq, well, we've certainly got rid of a regime, but by far and away the better way of doing that would have been by peaceful means. And the likelihood of democracy emerging in Iraq in the sense of Western democracy seems a long way away. Now, so in fact, you then end up with policies which are occupation, subjugation, and lengthy periods of uncertainty and instability, none of which was what the United States intended.
Ken, how do these arguments resonate with U.S. military professionals these days? Are they learning that the Clausewitzian position ain't necessarily so?
No, they tend to think that they've done something wrong operationally. They've used the wrong tactics. Are the wrong strategy.
So they blame themselves, do they?
It goes beyond that a bit, and they then will blame the lack of public support. They will blame the press, and now they will begin to blame the Congress. This is the same bifurcation that you saw during the Vietnam War, and it's alarming again that you have this feeling that if they'd only, they could have gotten it right. And our point in our book is that you can't get these things right, that it's an impossible goal to start with.
Kenneth, I should remind the listener that you're a professor of strategy and policy at the U.S. Naval War College in California.
Monterey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I am astonished that you are at liberty to teach these sort of arguments. Aren't you ever sort of court-martialed?
Well, no, I haven't been so far. And it is a college, and it is theoretically given to free inquiry and free expression of views. So I do this in the classroom environment and offer the students the opportunity to advance competing views. And the other view, I feel it's a genuine public service, and I hope that I'm not punished for it.
Going, as I did through the contents page just before we sat down together, I made the point that you've got a long list of Democrats and Republicans committing these wars or getting involved in wars with their unexpected outcomes. You're equal opportunity scholars here. If you were to have given all of them advice, if it were possible, even retrospectively, to give them advice, how should have they conducted these crises? Are you really arguing that overall, that most of them could have been avoided through ongoing diplomatic strategies?
Well, yes, we are, but we can't say too much along those lines because we don't want to be seen as complete loons. The political realities
incomplete
are,
loons is okay. Yes, yes,
an incomplete loons is fine, but the reality is that we believe that they too readily sought a resort to arms, and that they should have. That it would be much wiser, more prudent to have continued negotiations and to continue discussions. Even in the short term, certain things would have been better off. There'd have been fewer people dead, for example, and so on.
Good start.
The cost is too high of conflict. That's our argument, essentially.
I've had a couple of very distinguished US diplomats on the program lately who keep their titles as honorifics, who wholeheartedly agree with both of you with considerable eloquence and passion. I've enjoyed this, and I know that George Junior, will read it from cover to cover and heavily annotate it, and it may prevent Gulf War III. Yes. And let me remind the listener who I've been talking to. They are Ian Bickerton, Visiting Research Fellow in the School of History at the University of New South Wales, and Kenneth Hagen, Professor of Strategy and Policy at the US Naval War College, California, and even as we speak, they're coming to take him away. They're co-authors of Unintended Consequences, The United States at War, to be published this very month by Reaction Publishers and distributed here in the Antipodes by Footprint Books. And I thank you both very much. On our next, we'll continue our look at climate change and discuss its implication for human security, picking up where I left off with Gorby, my mate Mikhail Gorbachev a few months ago. And we'll also look at Stalin's war on science, which was even more strenuous than George W. Bush's war on science, and for pretty much the same reason. Stay tuned now on ABC Radio National for the news. And while Ian and Ken and I keep chatting away, see you later.
Radio National Podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.